Hi everyone, welcome back to the show. It's Louisa Nicola. I'm a neurophysiologist and human performance coach. I'm the founder of NeuroAthletics, where our mission is to democratize brain health education so you can perform better, think faster, and live longer. Today's guest is Dr. Kyle Gillette, who is a repeat offender on the podcast. Team, the world of peptides is a little bit of a sketchy territory, in my opinion. I've been seeing and hearing so many people talk about peptides, and especially here in New York City, the amount of new boutique clinics offering peptides for the management of infertility and longevity really warranted a discussion. So that is why Kyle is joining us today. I know some of you don't really understand where peptides fall in the realm of natural versus not natural and the practical applications for them. So especially when it comes down to recovery and overall health optimization. So that's what we're going to learn about today. And even bonus, I took a question from my community. If you haven't gone to my Instagram, which is Louisa Nicola underscore on Instagram, I have a private community there. But about a week before I bring on a guest, I put it out there and you guys get to ask questions. And so we had many questions come in and I chose one specific question for Kyle to answer. We start with that, then we finish off going into a crash course in peptides. I know you're going to love this episode. And if you haven't smashed the follow button on Apple iTunes, please do so. Also, please leave a review. Constructive criticism is my best friend. That would be super kind of you. Okay, let's go. Thank you to Boncharge for sponsoring today's episode. Boncharge is a wellness brand that has so many products ranging from blue light glasses, infrared saunas, red light therapy, EMF management. They also have red light panels and red light face masks. This is my ultimate beauty hack this year and also longevity hack. If you follow me on Instagram, you would have seen me wearing this red light in front of the red light panel. I do it every single morning for around 30 minutes. For those of you who don't know, red light therapy, also known as photobiomodulation, it really comes in two forms. You've got red light, then you've also got near infrared light. And these two wavelengths of light have the unique ability to penetrate the tissues, including the skin and superficial organs just beneath the skin. It's the new craze right now. Like so many people are using it to, I guess, increase their mitochondrial efficiency. And that is exactly what it does, because there has been a large body of peer-reviewed research that supports the idea that red light improves mitochondrial health, skin wound healing, and acne. Now, there's two specific studies that I want to point out that were done in humans outside of the University of College London. And they found that red light therapy, both near infrared and red light, when viewed for only just a couple of minutes each morning, improved the mitochondrial function of the neural retina and offsetted age-related vision loss. That's insane. So if you are, I'm saying a female, but men can, you know, obviously do this as well. Most females are turning to these red light therapy masks. I'm seeing them all over beauty clinics. If you go into maybe your skincare clinic where they do your Botox injections and your facials, you'll see near infrared light there because it penetrates the skin, your face, and I can actually, I guess it helps with age-related loss of collagen as well. It helps stimulate collagen. That's why I'm doing it. So there is so much to be learned on this. I'm going to do an actual episode related to this. But if you want to learn more and potentially purchase a panel, which I think everyone should have one in their home, or even a mask, then go to boncharge.com. Use code NEURO to save 15% off anything on their store. That is NEURO for 15% off. You won't be sorry. You will love it. Dr. Kyle Gillette, you're a veteran. Welcome back to the Neuro Experience.
Thank you for having me again.
I'm so excited. Ever since you came on our show, you didn't have your own show and now you do, and you're putting so many wonderful things out there for the world to listen, primarily around hormones, right?
Yeah, we could talk about anything health and fitness related, but most of what we talk about is hormone related, whether it be natural hormone optimization, fertility, HRT, et cetera.
Well, I'm going to get straight into it. So today we're going to talk specifically, instead of hormones, and you know, we did that. We did pretty much an introduction to hormones and hormonal health in the last episode, which I'll link. We're going to talk specifically today a few things about pregnancy, because I got a lot of questions from the NeuroExperience audience, and they mainly came from women. We're going to talk about that. Then we're going to spend most of the episode talking about peptides, because for some reason, I don't know whether it's just New York City, they seem to be the rage right now. And I don't know so much about them, and I want to know a lot about them. So we'll get into the first question, which was a question from the audience, which is there such thing as unexplained infertility?
Yeah, the answer to this is not really. If you dig deep enough, then with unlimited technology, you can find a cause for all cases of infertility. However, what most people refer to this is called third factor infertility. That's when there's part of the reason, if you will, is from the male, part of the reason is from the female. And you can't really, you know, I guess the way to think about this is you can't assign quote unquote blame in a lot of factors of fertility. Because a lot of times someone will ask the doc, hey, you know, is it me? Is it my wife or whatnot? And they're saying, well, not really either. And a lot of times, you know, instead of doing a huge workup, they do things that are both diagnostic and therapeutic. For example, try a therapy where they presume a cause of infertility. And if the and if there is fertility, then it tells you, yes, this is the cause, and also it's therapeutic.
Yeah, I think, and this question obviously leads into the next one, because we were talking offline and you mentioned around a lot of women who maybe can't fall pregnant. They're trying really hard, then they end up taking a break, they go on a holiday, and then they end up falling pregnant. And this is, I think, where a lot of the confusion is around females. And I know there is it's a 50-50, and we'll talk about that in a second. But then if that's the case, you know, people de-stressing, does that mean like cortisol has a lot to do with falling pregnant?
It can. Most hormones have quite a bit to do with falling pregnant, and more is not necessarily better. Less is also not necessarily better. A lot of the times I see individuals who have previously been told they are unlikely to get pregnant, it's because they have a certain pathology which they've improved. So something in the lifestyle has changed, something in regards to their hormone status, their body fat percentage could be higher or could be lower than before. So it could be someone with hypothalamic amenorrhea that has a higher body fat than she did, or different leptin receptor signaling, or different cortisol signaling. Better cortisol signaling is a potential cause. But one of the things that I see the most is individuals who are previously doing something that drastically decreased fertility, and they are no longer doing that. One example, and I've had patients like this, is, you know, they have a history of endometriosis, and they were on some Orilissa, which is a medication that kind of shuts down the pituitary. Mm-hmm. And whether it's Orilissa or Lupron, and doesn't matter if you don't know what those medications mean, basically they just turn off the switch, and you're told, oh yeah, this is not going to permanently turn off things, but the switch is not turned all the way back on as fast as you would think. Sometimes it takes years.
So what else could potentially be in the way there?
Metabolic syndrome is most common. So, you know, you think about the insulin resistant axis, or the X-axis type PCOS, where there's hyperinsulinemia, too much androgen signaling in the ovary, too many follicles, and things like that. You tend to see a high AMH. And then the opposite end of the spectrum, or the continuum, would be hypothalamic amenorrhea, where there's no hypothalamic signaling, and you're not having enough input at the ovaries.
That might happen in like long distance runners, for example, because I know that some of them, you know, if you're an athlete of some sort and you're going really hard, and maybe you don't experience your menstrual cycle, not because you're on any medications each month, it's just maybe you're over exercising.
That could be. And of course there's the female athlete triad, if people aren't familiar with that. So a lot of times you see anemia along with that, And often you see low body fat percentages too. But even at the same body composition, diet matters quite a bit. In fact, this could, hypothalamic amenorrhea is not extremely common, but if you tend to have lighter periods, or a lot of times you just have a bit of spotting, or they're more near every 35 days instead of every 28 to 30, then you might be more on that side of the spectrum. If you get a DEXA scan and your body fat's under 20% as a female, that should be not full alarm bells, but just little warning bells that you should be cognizant of your hypothalamic signaling. The hypothalamus, of course, is in kind of the top of the brainstem, sends signals to many endocrine organs in the body, but one of them is the pituitary to release the gonadotropins, the LH and FSH, among other things. But an interesting thing about diet is if you have really high amounts of EPA driving triglycerides down, or anything in general that drives triglycerides down, that tends to decrease leptin signaling in the hypothalamus, which may not be wanted. So occasionally I see people that are megadosing omegas, omega-3s specifically, and that might make them overly leptin sensitive without enough leptin signaling. And occasionally I also see people that are avoiding fructose. So you can consume fructose if you're on an isocaloric diet. It can affect leptin signaling, but if you're on this hypothalamic amenorrheic side of the spectrum, or even athlete's triad side of the spectrum, a lot of doctors will tell you, well, eat more fat. That's not necessarily the case. You just think about, well, what would you do that's opposite as someone who has PCOS? So you eat more fructose. You consume less canola oil, because canola oil can be healthy if you get canola oil that's processed wrong. So it's just, I love that hyper-extreme example of you have two different patients and you're telling them to do opposite things.
Can the likely occur if you've got high body fat percentage? Because I know you said below 20. What about if it's on the other end of the spectrum?
Yeah, usually you would be on like the insulin-resistant X-axis type PCOS, where you have a higher AMH, you have a lot of ovarian follicles, you could do a follicle count in the ovaries and you would have a whole bunch of them. You might get a PCOS diagnosis if you meet Rotterdam criteria or other criteria. And I would argue that is much more common, at least in the United States, than this other end of the spectrum. Although there's probably a lot of athletes listening to the podcast. So maybe among this podcast listeners, it's about 50-50.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for clearing that up. We're going to move into peptides now. First of all, before we go into what they are and the different types of peptides, is there a reason why this is becoming such a boutique kind of accessory right now, especially in Manhattan?
Yes, it's a great question. Two main reasons. And, you know, I see peptides like I do any other supplement or medication. They're usually medications. Sometimes peptides are supplements like creatine and carnitine. They're both peptides. Creatine's a tripeptide. Glutathione's a tripeptide. Three amino acids. Carnitine's a dipeptide. Two amino acids.
Mm. Is that the same as acetyl L-carnitine?
Acetyl L-carnitine is just the dipeptide carnitine with an acetyl group attached.
So same thing then.
So yeah, for all intents and purposes, they're the same thing. And, you know, there's a bunch of different forms of carnitine. And if you're going to take really high doses of oral L-carnitine, it probably does make sense to take multiple forms so that it's absorbed in the gut via multiple mechanisms. For example, instead of taking, I think there's an S-adenosyl carnitine as well, a life extension. Mm-hmm. I have no connection to the brand. They have two forms of L-carnitine that are very unique. So sometimes if people are taking a lot of L-carnitine, most common reason for that, if they don't want to inject the L-carnitine, they're trying to improve their sperm motility. A lot of people take higher doses of L-carnitine. There can be other reasons too for ovarian health. A lot of times I'll use higher doses of L-carnitine, but you can combine, for example, four forms, each for 1 gram, rather than taking 4 grams of one form, because absorption and bioavailability is very difficult with carnitine. But anyway,
I did hear a very well-known fertility doctor speak about high dose L-carnitine being good for ovarian health, and you know, the making them I guess, stronger, if you will, or healthier. And she did mention at a dose of 4 grams a day, but she didn't mention the differences in, you know, different types. And I think that's interesting because to take 4 grams of creatine per day in capsule form, you're taking like, I don't know, depending on the supplement, maybe like 10 pills, and that's just of the one supplement. But is it true that L-carnitine increases TMAO?
Yeah, it's a great question. Any carnitine or choline derivative or naturally occurring carnitine in red meat can increase TMAO. But TMAO is formed most often in individuals with dysbiotic gut flora, which most people don't know. And even if you've had a Genova comprehensive stool analysis or a vibrant gut zoomer or a GI map, there's a lot of different types of stool tests. And people argue about the validity of them all day. But at the end of the day, they are all good at what they do. But if you stool a lot or don't stool a lot, it's like testing the exhaust that comes out of your car. So it's like you're testing the residue, which tells you a whole lot about what's happening in the engine. But depending on how hard the engine runs that day and depending on how many times you run the engine that day, it's going to have a different result. So probiotics can help decrease the amount of TMAO that's converted. For individuals that have a lot of or L-carnitine supplemented, I just test the TMAO.
Okay.
I see if it's high. And by the way, for those who don't know, TMAO is a potential carcinogen. It is likely a carcinogen in a high enough dose or high enough level. And I try to keep people below about 10. But I know that I know individuals who are not taking berberine or allicin or anything else that can decrease conversion to TMAO. And they have taken 4 grams of oral L-carnitine. And as I mentioned, choline precursors like alpha-GPC, phosphatidylserine, phosphatidylcholine, choline bitartrate, they can all also lead to more TMAO. And I have seen people on really high doses of both, not on probiotics, just with healthy gut microbiomes and with undetectable TMAO levels. So it's definitely possible to take a whole bunch of choline and carnitine and not have your TMAO go up. But anytime people ask me about CoQ10 or glutathione or omegas or TMAO or even carnitine, I just like to check all those things because we have the lab assays to do that.
And interestingly, I believe if you take garlic, like raw garlic, if you cut it up, or even like garlic capsules, that can help lower TMAO.
Yeah. Allicin is the active ingredient in garlic, which helps decrease the conversion of choline and carnitine to TMAO. So that is a great dietary intervention. It's easy to get caught up taking too many supplements, but...
That's why I always say get blood. I'm such a big proponent of blood testing. Every like 6 months, in my opinion, if you could do it twice a year, great. But really understanding your blood biomarkers before you go and supplement with, you know, grams and grams and grams of an unregulated product that you don't know is even working. So that's
That is excellent advice. But yeah, hopefully that rabbit trail was appreciated.
Sorry, guys.
To some degree. I know we're talking about
peptides. Okay, we'll get back into peptides. Okay, what are they?
Yeah, so peptides are strings of amino acids. They can be between two. So I guess carnitine would be the smallest possible peptide. There's other dipeptides and a couple hundred amino acids, usually about 100. I think that from the pharmaceutical side of things, it's now limited to something like 47 amino acids. I don't remember off the top of my head, but I know that things like TB500 are underneath that arbitrary amino acid limit. And then things like GHFRAG, which used to be called, or is now called AOD9604, used to be under the arbitrary amino acid limit, and now it's not under the new arbitrary amino acid limit. So I guess if I seem a little bit jaded, it's just because, whatever definition that they're trying to give peptides, the way that I see peptides, if they are a peptide like creatine or carnitine or glutathione, I see those, they can be prescribed and they can be over the counter. And then all other peptides, essentially, I consider medications. And if they can be prescribed at pharmacies or compounding pharmacies, there's a whole list of FDA-approved peptides. I did a newsletter for people that are on my mailing list that talked about all the currently FDA-approved peptides. Insulin is one of my favorite ones. Wow. So people forget about there's peptides that have been around for a long time, and people tend to forget about them. People are usually most excited about peptides that are just on that cusp of FDA approval. And I think a lot of the reason behind that, number one, is because GLP-1s, glucagon-like peptides, have excellent applicability in the right patient. They're certainly not for every man, woman, and child. And then the second reason for that is there's a lot of clinics which recommend peptides or talk about peptides that make a lot of money from them. So I think that their promotion of peptides as these new things that big pharma is hiding from us. I don't think pharmaceutical companies have our best interest in heart. I think they also want to make money, but I think that the clinics that are kind of promoting peptides too early also want to make money. So if you're wondering why something's happening, first follow the money, and then you'll probably find out why that is.
Actually, I refer to these as designer peptides, because what I'm seeing currently, especially in Manhattan here in New York, is this anti-aging scene. And now, peptides are coming up saying, we can use peptides to help with fertility, to help with skin aging, to help with hair growth. Of course, every woman in Manhattan is going to run there and get the next injection.
Yeah.
Like I would.
Yeah. So
I haven't yet, because I haven't spoken to you about it.
Yeah. And there's a lot of applicability. So I've talked about the various medications and supplements that happen to be peptides that I've been prescribed and I've used. People know that I've used PRP for my Achilles tendonitis, for which I think it worked quite well. But I've also used BPC-157. So, why not both? For? And I think that they have helped Achilles tendonitis.
Okay.
So things like that do help quite a bit, but there's several main classes of peptides. I know I've also talked with Thomas DeLauer about the classes of peptides. And then I also have a peptide family tree. If people have seen the anabolic steroid family tree, I'm making a family tree of peptides, which have a bunch of different classes, but most people are interested in the growth agonists, which are very similar risks and benefits to HGH, human growth hormone. And then you have your growth promoting peptides. Those are like your BPC-157, which actually just upregulates angiogenesis or new blood vessel formation. And then GHK copper peptide comes from the liver, growth promoting. TB500, which is a chopped up version of thymosin beta 4, comes from the thymus, an organ that's usually just present in young children. You also have other thymic peptides like thymulin or thymosin alpha 1, which in my opinion are not quite there with clinical applicability and like risk benefit ratio at this time, but they're awfully close. And then you have your melanocortin receptor agonist. Several of these are FDA approved. Setmelanotide is one of them, which is called Imvigri. And then bremelanotide is another one, and that's called Vyleesi. So those are kind of the main overarching classes.
One class that I am really excited to talk to you about, because I believe it relates to brain health, is VEGF. And I don't know whether that's a class. Is that a class of peptides?
Yeah, the only one that I know that directly promotes VEGF is BPC-157. Okay. There might be others. PRP also has a lot of VEGF in it. VEGF is actually technically a cytokine, but as you mentioned, it's not as pro-inflammatory as most of the other cytokines, and it's not heavily skewed, as far as I know, towards like TH1, TH2, or TH17 immune system, like many cytokines are. But yeah, that's very likely one of the reasons PRP works so well in areas that are not well vascularized, is it improves angiogenesis. BPC-157 is kind of the opposite of something like Avastin. So you think about the side effects of Avastin, which is a cancer medication, one of the WHO's essential medications, and is often used in ophthalmology for cell overgrowth. So Avastin is a VEGF inhibitor. So it's literally the opposite of BPC-157. So BPC-157 does have some trials in Crohn's disease. So it might have other uses. but it is particularly exciting. VEGF is one of those things, like you could probably make a horror movie about it. It's probably the fountain of youth, but there, it's also kind of like a, if it's systemic, then it's a shotgun-based growth agonist that can grow all tissues. So it's a little bit scary as well.
Well, VEGF can be improved with exercise. And that's how I, you know, I was relating the two, because VEGF would be obviously incredible, especially as it relates to brain health and vascularization. So I think that's interesting. What about, okay, so what are the ones that are in, you know, I'm going to be really like low key right now and just ask you like all the things that I think about when I open up Instagram, and, you know, what about the ones that like improve age and longevity, the ones that act, what about skin health? What are the ones that are like, oh, you can get peptides to improve, I don't know, skin health and make you look younger? Is that a thing?
Yeah. The skin peptides, the ones that are actually peptides, GHK copper peptide is in a lot of prescription and over the counter creams. And I do think that is helpful for skin health. GHK copper peptide is also, I forget what the patches are named, Life Something, that claim to increase endogenous GHK copper peptide production, but they also market it to very old individuals, which have livers that are not, that do not have as good of synthetic potential. So you think about someone who is a geriatric population and liver is not making as good GHK copper peptide, they're probably better off just taking the peptide rather than depending on their liver to make it. If that makes sense. But I do think that one has good utility in over-the-counter peptide creams. If they don't say they're GHK, those are usually hexapeptides. And there's a couple different types of hexapeptides, hexa for six. And I do think that those are helpful for aesthetic purposes as well. I would call them growth-promoting and regenerative, not necessarily anti-aging. I know that I've done a podcast before with Alec McCarthy, a regenerative medicine PhD, that has published an insane amount of research on regenerative medicine, contrasting with degenerative medicine. So usually, you know, instead of destroying the skin or doing surgery or injecting, exogenous fillers that are not using the body's natural processes. Instead, using these things like peptides or growth factors or other ways to stimulate natural fibroblast production, proteoglycan, type 1 and type 3 collagen, elastin, and more.
Oh, damn, that's what I need. I know that there's a huge rise in PRP instead of fillers now. And I know that there's this new craze with fat injections instead of getting fillers under the eyes, which I've never had any of those. But I mean, if I was to do anything, I would caution against the synthetic and go straight to the PRP or the fat injections. That's great. Like, take it out of my leg and just like put it under my eye. That would be fantastic.
Yeah, at some point I do plan to do PRP injections under my eyes, if for no other reason, so that people stop saying that I look tired.
That's nice. The internet's a really nice world. What about SARM, SARMs?
So SARMs are selective androgen receptor modifiers, not technically peptides and not steroids, but they do bind the androgen receptor. So some people are familiar with Clomid, which is clomiphene or enclomiphene, one of its diastereoisomers, right hand to left hand, if you will. Some people are also familiar with raloxifene or tamoxifen, which is Novaldex. Those are selective estrogen receptor modifiers that either block or activate estrogen receptors. SARMs will block or activate androgen receptors, and there is likely naturally occurring SARMs as well. I've always postulated that Substantia tubulosa, I believe, in Chinese traditional medicine is a naturally occurring SARM, but we just don't know which receptors it agonizes or antagonizes, other than the pituitary. We know that it is an antagonist at the pituitary, at least at the androgen receptor. But the most promising SARM, if you will, is enobosarm, E-N-O-B-O-S-A-R-M. This has been renamed. It was previously called MK2866, and before that it was called Osterine, that some people might realize. But this is extremely promising for something called triple negative breast cancer that's actually grown by androgens, because it can activate the androgen receptor throughout the body. So it's not going to cause, you know, osteoporosis and muscle wasting in females. And it's also not going to cause, you know, unwanted hair growth or male pattern baldness, like damasterone, which is drostanolone, or like the methinolone, or any of these other androgens that we used to give females that had androgen receptor negative breast cancer. This is kind of the opposite, because in general, you'd think you actually want to activate the androgen receptor. And that is the case with estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. But for this rare type of breast cancer called triple negative, you actually might want less androgenic activity. So Ostarine is promising for that. And it's also very promising for prostate cancer patients.
Well, interesting.
Yep. In the future, perhaps it could be used for burn patients, especially burn patients who are children. But there's a lot of research ahead before it does that. But it's very interesting because it's considered, and it's actually not completely non-virilizing, but compared to androgens, I suppose, it is non-virilizing. And compared to anti-androgens, because you think about prostate cancer, you use flutamide, you use things that block the androgen receptor or block androgen production or block adrenal androgen production very strongly. And compared to that, it's not near as bad on the muscle wasting standpoint of things. And from the development of metabolic syndrome and diabetes. So for every condition, as a thought experiment, we could design the perfect SARM. And we do talk about this on the Gillette Health podcast from time to time. And we think, for this condition, what is the perfect SARM for this patient?
Oh, wow. Yeah, exactly. So everyone's different. This is why I don't think that you should be doing this with someone who is A, unlicensed, if that's possible, and B, someone who just doesn't know really too much about what they're doing, even if they are an MD or DO. I think it takes a very specialized person like yourself to understand the intricacies of peptides.
Yeah, certainly. So yeah, SARMs is definitely something I'm very excited about, but they're not quite at the point where I think they have a lot of clinical utility for patients with certain conditions, especially in clinical trials, but we're probably 5 to 10 years away from off-label usage of these. But I do think that enobosarm will get its FDA approval within 2 to 5 years.
Oh, everything I'm waiting for. 2 to 5 years, guys, 2 to 5 years. I feel like, you know, that's going to be a really exciting time. You mentioned earlier, I don't know what you were referring to, but you did say the fountain of youth hormone, but it wasn't DHEA. And I've heard that DHEA is the fountain of youth hormone.
Yeah. VEGF, which is technically a cytokine. So not really a hormone, but yeah, from a standpoint of function, having a lot more VEGF and angiogenesis in any area of the body from a function standpoint is definitely good. From a, you know, a tumor growth standpoint, I guess you could argue it's the opposite of the fountain of youth. Same thing for HGH. There's no such thing as a free lunch. There's always an upside and a downside to every intervention. But yeah, from DHEA, DHEA is what I call the pawn on the chessboard of hormones. And it is a great backup hormone. So it can be converted to testosterone. It can also be converted to estradiol. In fact, after menopause, it is the sole source of estradiol. Most of it converts intracellularly throughout the body. So having plenty of DHEA around is a good backup plan. For example, if someone has a whole bunch of DHEA, maybe they have NCCAH, which is a somewhat common condition where you just have a whole bunch of adrenal production of it, then they'll probably have less menopause symptoms and have decent estradiol and testosterone levels after menopause and have less symptoms. So I could see why people would consider it the fountain of youth, but in and of itself, it's a very weak hormone.
But you can get that from supplementation. I know I was like slightly low, like very slightly low in DHEAS. Is that the same thing?
Yeah, so DHEAS is DHEA sulfate. Okay. Most of adrenally produced DHEA has sulfate attached via sulfotransferase enzyme. And at least 80% of your DHEAS comes from your adrenals. So we always test the DHEAS. That's the lab assay that you want your doctor to check, because that is what is going to tell you how your adrenals are functioning. And yes, ACTH does lead to the production of both cortisol and DHEAS. So really, instead of thinking about, you know, and there is utility to looking at cortisol to cortisone and other glucocorticoid ratios, but you really want to look at the ratio of DHEAS to cortisol.
And you mentioned that it's the, I guess, precursor to estradiol, but then how does that affect estrogen?
Yeah. Estradiol would just be considered your most powerful estrogen.
Okay.
But DHEAS is not extremely estrogenic, particularly in females. So in females, DHEA supplementation can lead to decreased SHBG. So you want to check SHBG before and after starting.
Oh,
there's other things.
I didn't know that. I'll do that.
Yeah. There's, in fact, Dr. Fernand Labrie, L-A-B-R-I-E, he recently passed away.
Oh.
He was a well-respected researcher that actually also looked at CIRMs. But I believe it was University of Montreal or Toronto. But he had a bunch of great ideas, and he frequently tried to include DHEA in a whole bunch of medications, which I think is one of the reasons why it's controlled in Canada. It's actually pretty high on their equivalent of the FDA schedule. So you definitely don't want to take your, DHEA and just look at it as only a supplement. It can be a medication as well, but I do think it should be over the counter in Canada, all that being said. But the point being is that it can decrease SHBG. I know my friend, and I've talked about this with my friend Derek, who has the More Plates, More Dates channel. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of women on oral contraceptives that have suppressed their androgens. Mm-hmm. You can suppress them, and not just oral contraceptives. If they're just on estrogen and progesterone as HRT, you're also suppressing your androgen level. So if you just search female menopause testosterone and you look for that chart where you compare people that take estrogen versus not, testosterone and free androgens especially decrease quite a bit, and DHEA can be a great way to rectify that. So there's a lot of high-level female athletes, college and professional athletes, that are allowed, not to get into that topic, allowed to take DHEA, and they do so because they also are on an oral contraceptive.
Yeah. Interestingly, I think maybe that's why I started taking it, because I think my testosterone was slightly low and so was DHEA. And I thought that there would be a, I mean, I'm not talking like anything like to cause of concern. It was just like slightly. And you know what I'm like? I'm like, got to be hyper-optimized. So I think that's why I started taking it probably around 6 months ago, DHEA. And interestingly, I don't know if you know this, there is a really tight link between DHEA and REM sleep. And my REM sleep is actually, because I found a really great article on PubMed, my REM sleep has gone through the roof. It's sitting at like 29%. But prior to the DHEA, it was at like 14%. And I'm like, this is insane. So I investigated, and then that's how I saw that article.
Yeah. For a lot of females, DHEA can be particularly dopaminergic. You get that benefit. And you probably would have gotten the same benefit if you took a very low dose of testosterone as well. It's not necessarily unique to DHEA. One thing that's unique to DHEA is it's also a sigma-1 receptor agonist. So it helps with parasympathetic tone. So a lot of people with ADHD or that are on stimulants for whatever reason take it to potentiate their dose, to get more bang for the buck. So that's something that DHEA is also very good at. But it really is a jack of all trades. And the more skewed you are one way or another, the more DHEA will work. So DHEA works, or people feel it the most, if they start with a very high SHBG, or if they start with a very low SHBG. We usually see acne and hair loss because it can be converted to DHT very quickly.
Yeah.
So some females end up on something to account for that while they're on DHEA. But it's a great addition. I usually have females start at 10 milligrams and males start at 25 milligrams, but a lot of females can tolerate more than that.
Interesting. Okay, I'm going to look at my dosage. Melanocortins, did I say it correct?
Yeah.
So, okay, I'm guessing that has something to do with the melanocytes and becoming darker. And is that why some people in the bodybuilding space are injecting themselves with this? Is that what it is, to make themselves darker?
Yes, there's actually several types of melanocortin receptors, and a lot of these medications bind two different melanocortin receptors, and one of them causes nausea, and also causes lack of appetite, and also causes slight hyperpigmentation of the skin. So it can darken freckles. Your hair might lose some of its photo bleaching effect if a little bit of it does get lighter in the hair and the sun in the summer. And then if you have a whole bunch of it, like non-clinical doses, it can slightly darken the pigment of the eyes as well. Mm. But these are prescribed for a few different main reasons. One of the reasons is hypoactive sexual disorder, whatever that is. I always make that joke because it's obviously relative to your partner and your situation, blah, 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 blah.
Hypo.
Okay. One of the side effects of it is priapism, or prolonged engorgement of erectile tissues in males and females. And it's actually FDA approved for females, but not for males, but it can definitely be used for both. A side effect would be nausea and flushing. So the brand name of this is called Vileesi, V-Y-L-E-E-S-I. And I know that several companies are kind of studying this bremelanotide molecule to see how they can have it be slightly longer acting or slightly less severe from like the nausea or flushing standpoint. But, and I do plan to have one of the PhDs for one of these companies. He's one of their field directors or medical science liaisons. I do plan to have him on the Gillette Health podcast to specifically talk about his peptide. Mm-hmm. I think it's hilarious that he refers to his medication as his peptide. Mm-hmm. But he has setmelanotide, which is Imvikri, and it's indicated for different hyperphagic syndromes. For example, mm-hmm. Genetic obesities or Bardet-Biedl syndrome or leptin receptor deficiencies. It is likely to get FDA approved for many more causes if they can come out with a longer acting version of the peptide. If you remember exenatide, one of the very early GLP-1s, or Victoza even, you had to inject it every day. And now we have the longer acting ones, and that's really when things picked up. So I think when we have the longer acting, weaker melanocortin receptor agonist, we're going to have a boom of that as well.
Okay. So say there's people listening and they're like, where do I even start? Do I need to start? Like, give me the lowdown. What should people do if they, like, first of all, who should be taking peptides? Let's start there.
Yeah. The way that I phrase that question is I just kind of rephrase it, because the peptides like these are medications, and there's already multiple FDA approved melanocortin receptor agonists. So I kind of phrase the same question, but with a different word. Where should people start when it comes to these medications? And should people be taking these medications? And the way that I explain it is, whatever the medication is, you can talk to your physician, and you have them explain all the benefits and all the risks. That's a scale. So think about it, balancing the scale, and you want the benefits of that medication to outweigh the risks. And people say, well, my physician, she or he has no idea what any of these medications are, and I would encourage
you. Get a new physician.
Just like if your lawyer has no idea about case law and accounting, then you should probably find a new one that has an idea about case law and accounting. Although some physicians are willing to learn if you have one that at least spends a lot of time with you and does that shared decision-making process. That's what they actually teach it in med schools. So physicians should at least know. You could say, hey, I want to do shared decision-making with you for this FDA-approved medication called Vileesi. And if my insurance doesn't cover it, I would like to consider a high-quality compounding pharmacy. Your physician, if he or she is a decent listener, then they can go, you know, there's no shame in learning things. That's why we have CME, continuing medical education, and they can look it up and try the process of prescribing.
Okay. That's a first step. That's okay. If they want to go and do it. And then what would you say would be the biggest, is there like it's not the same as taking testosterone, really, peptides. It's not the same as taking like injectable testosterone, right? I think there's more like harm in doing that than taking peptides.
For most peptides, yes. So if you're thinking about short courses of something for a specific issue, you know, the melanocortin receptors, if you take a dose of bremelanotide 4 times a month, then there's likely not a lot of harm. Although there is specific niche scenarios. You know, if you ask the companies that have the melanocortin receptor agonists, and I've asked both representatives of both companies, there is no concern for melanoma in their trials.
Oh, okay.
But because melanoma cells do have receptors on them, theoretically, they would grow your melanoma. Although, again, in the clinical trials, they went all the way through the FDA approval process, which for most medications, unless you pay that expedited fee or whatnot, they have like an expedited fee, which is a little sketchy to me, then it's very difficult to do that. So I think that they're relatively safe. But if you have a strong family history of melanoma, I would consider that a relative contraindication to the melanocortin receptor agonist, especially if you're going to take them very frequently.
Mm.
The dose makes the poison. When it comes to GHRPs, again, the relative contraindication there, not that there isn't, you know, it is a little bit more straightforward than TRT, but you'd have to go through every single organ system in the body, or HRT, again, every single organ system in the body. With the GHRPs, tumor growth is the main risk.
Mm.
Similar risk to taking growth hormone, and then hyperglycemia.
Mm.
So in individuals that, for example, are missing their cancer screens, they really shouldn't start a GHRP or HGH. The nice thing with GHRPs is that they have the regulatory system of the body to where it is more difficult to go supraphysiologic. So there's a little bit of a speed limit. You still can, but that's why those are often preferred. And although the FDA approved ones for those, often they're used for growth hormone deficiency. They can also be used for lipodystrophy, which is an abnormal distribution of body fat just centrally, and also muscle wasting. And they can also be used for things like leptin receptor deficiencies, other rare conditions. The short courses of peptides like BPC-157, TB-500, because you're only using it, for example, for 6 weeks, then you have a limitation on the exposure, which decreases your risk significantly.
So pretty much as long as you're doing the screening, okay, you're doing your blood tests and you're getting your peptides or anything when it comes to hormones checked by a really wonderful physician such as yourself, then you can be rest assured that you're doing the right thing. And if you're doing it for the right purpose, then that's okay too.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good summary. Sometimes when I talk about things like these, people are instead of being encouraged, they're kind of discouraged.
Mm.
But somebody has to talk about the risks and benefits of everything. And again, if somebody asked me to talk about a medication, I would be equally as optimistic, but also harsh on the potential side effects, because there's no such thing as a free lunch. There's always something that could potentially get you. So that's the job of the healthcare provider, physician, NP, whatever situation they're in, is just thinking about what's the main risk in that patient's case and what's the main benefit. Mm-hmm. And it's extremely important that you tell the patient both of those things.
I love that. So where can we find out more about you? Where's your podcast? And are you taking new patients? Like, tell me everything.
Yeah, will do. Thank you for the reminder. So my main hub, I guess, historically has been on Instagram, Kyle Gillette MD, but I'm now at Gillette Health on all platforms as well. We have our podcast. We post on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. It's just called Gillette Health. And our website is gillettehealth.com. We do take new patients from almost all states. But at this time, our locations are just in Kansas City and Los Angeles. But we do take telemedicine patients as well. And I also post my lab panels. Even if you don't order labs from the Gillette Health website, I post all the markers in case you want to take them to your regular doctor or try to run through insurance or whatever. I post all the biomarkers on the Gillette Health website.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. For specific conditions or just a whole round panel?
Somewhat specific conditions. So there's a little bit more in depth for thyroid or nutrients or fertility, or separated between more basic and advanced panels for males and females. I believe I have one for hair loss that everyone should get before they start hair loss meds. It's not ideal, and I'll keep working on it, but it's better than nothing.
Do you give reference ranges as well?
I don't give the lab printout has a reference range, but but I do at this time, I do not have an optimal reference range. Mm. It's difficult to make an optimal reference range because it's different for each patient. Uh-huh. So a lot of times I'll tell a patient, what's my goal? Common questions I get is, what's an optimal estradiol after menopause? It's actually really variable.
Yeah.
Sometimes I even check free estradiols because if you have a high SHBG, maybe you need a higher estradiol after menopause. Maybe you need it to be 60 picograms per mil. For testosterone, for most females on HRT that includes an androgen, you look at SHBG, and the higher your SHBG, the higher you want testosterone. So a total testosterone of 100 nanograms per deciliter in a female with a high SHBG of also 100, that does not concern me whatsoever. For males in general, you want your total T between about 550 and 1,000, assuming your free T is at least 12 to 15 nanograms per deciliter.
You heard it here, ladies and gentlemen. Dr. Kyle Gillette, thank you for being part of the Neuro Experience podcast.
Thank you. My pleasure.